We listen to Ronnie. Ronnie remembers.
Maybe far away, or maybe real nearby. He may be pouring her coffee, she may be straightening his tie. Maybe in a house, all hidden by a hill, she's sitting playing piano. He's sitting paying a bill. Betcha they're young, betcha they're smart, bet they collect things like ashtrays and art. Betcha they're good, why shouldn't they be? Their one mistake was giving up me. So maybe now it's time. They'll be there calling me baby. Maybe.
Today's guest could have been a meteorologist, but despite accurately predicting that the sun would come out tomorrow, showing a natural grasp of the obvious, that was one line of work that I don't believe that she ever pursued. But when it comes to being a polished entertainer, she has an amazing resume with so many show business activities. Now, of course, Annie has to be at the top of the list. For starring in that film, she received 2 Golden Globe Award nominations. Best Performance by an Actress in a Motion Picture, Comedy or Musical, and New Star of the Year. But there are so many other things. I hear her in the background. She can't wait till I say her name. I am so thrilled to welcome to our show with a drum roll that Daddy Warbucks would be proud of. The entertainer who played the title role in the 1982 film version of Annie. Welcome, Annie. Aileen Quinn.
Hello, everybody. And Ronnie.
This, I guarantee you, is going to be the quintessential Aileen Quinn show, because we're going to go from beginning to the middle, to the after the middle, to the end, and you have an amazing story.
Well, thank you.
The song we just heard a little bit of was from the beginning of the film. That song is called Maybe. I believe that you said in a YouTube video, the song that is my favorite from the film is not Tomorrow, but it is Maybe. Did I get that right?
That is correct. I think it's a beautiful, beautiful song.
You were born in Yardley, Pennsylvania. And by the way, I lived almost next door to you in Morrisville, Pennsylvania.
I think you really did. I think we might have even had the same zip code, yes.
As a young girl, prior to Annie, do you recall what singers you were most fond of? I understand the music that you were really into, actually, as a young girl, was rockabilly. I know you liked Wanda Jackson.
Definitely. And as a matter of fact, before I even found out about Wanda Jackson, when I first got my first little boombox for Christmas when I was 9 or 10 years old, the Stray Cats were on the radio. So I learned how to record on my little cassette back then, which for some of you out there, like, what?
Oh,
cassette tape? I used to listen to the radio, and they had all the Stray Cats songs.
Yeah.
Rock This Town, and of course, the Stray Cats strut. So cool.
Oh. Did you know, kind of from the get-go, when you were very young, that you wanted to be in show business?
Sort of. I did, in a way. I guess when I went on my first audition, it was because I saw my mother singing around the house. She was in theater herself. So I'm actually a third-generation performer in my family on the women's side. My grandmother was a performer, my mom, and then me. And so I used to watch my mom singing around the house, and then I saw one of her dress rehearsals for Bye Bye Birdie, which I later did myself. But I watched her, and she just was having so much fun. She wasn't the school teacher mom that I knew growing up and do the dishes and, you know, mom. She was having a blast, and I said, wow, that looks fun. So she definitely influenced me, not in the stage mom way, but just like seeing how much joy it brought her. I thought, maybe I want to try that. So my first audition, I kind of knew that I wanted to pursue it. I was always torn between doing something like that or doing what you're doing, actually, being an interviewer, interviewing people.
You mean you really thought you'd like to be an interviewer back then? You said I may want to interview
people? Yes, and I think I said that in one of my interviews when I was 10 or 11 years old, either before or after Annie. It's true. Yeah, I thought about the other side of it, going around and traveling and meeting people that do many different things, including entertainment.
Your mom's name, by the way, Helen Ann.
Helen Ann. You said it right. Be very proud.
Okay. Do I get 2 stars?
Two stars. You got it.
And interestingly, you performed in a local community theater production of Annie Gets Your Gun.
Yes. As a matter of fact, that's that audition I was referring to. Yes.
Oh, what role did you play in that?
Well, that was a funny thing. It was my first big audition, and I did get in the show, but it was very small. I just played the little girl. So he kept picking me up and saying, like, you know, move over or get out of here, little girl. The big, tough male character just picked me up and dropped me off.
Was he the Buffalo Bill character?
Yes. I remember him as a very big, strong man, and I was this extra petite, 7 and a half, turning 8-year-old. And he just picked me up and kept plopping me all over the stage. So, yeah, I was in the production, but I had a small part.
It strikes me as funny that before you did Annie, you did an Annie show.
I know.
Show.
It was a little bit of a premonition, right?
Irving Berlin, by the way, wrote all the songs from that show. Did you take lessons in voice and or dancing?
I sure did. Speaking of our old Pennsylvania buddies, Russ Faith was one of my first singing teachers, and he would let me choose songs that were popping from the radio, and my true love back then, it's now switched a little bit, but I loved dance. Dance was always my first love, and I used to go to Connect Dance Academy, another local Levittown favorite. They were wonderful teachers and became family friends. I'm still friends with the Connects. So I called them Mr. Fred and Miss Joanne. Joanne and Fred Connect.
You already had a career before you auditioned for Annie, including appearing in several TV commercials.
Yes, national and regional. I did about 6 within 2 years. Boom, 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 commercials.
Was one of the products that you were selling bathroom tissue? You knew what I was going to say.
Yes, I did. It was Northern bathroom tissue because, as I said when I was, I think, 8, Stroft is especially soft. I still remember that line.
Now, Annie was not the first film that you were actually in. You were in another film with Burt Reynolds called Paternity.
That's true. Yes, I did actually that first. While I was doing the commercials, I did get a small role in a film. Correct. And you're going to love this. We filmed it in Central Park, our scene, because we were a bunch of students on a field trip. And I only had one line. And the other girl who he chose to speak, he chose us out of 50 students. He picked us to speak with the director. Right. And the other girl, she said, I'd call it smart. And I said, I'd call it lucky. And she ended up being the girl in Mommy Dearest. Two starring roles a year or year and a half later at the same time. So Bert, I think he was a good luck charm.
I guess he was. Everything kind of overlapped here. And
yes.
Now,
I was working a lot since 8 years old.
You are actually in the show Annie on Broadway before you ever auditioned for the motion picture Annie.
Correct.
And in fact, you are a swing orphan. Now, does that mean that you went into the playground and spent the entire day going back and forth? Or did
well,
it mean...
if you consider the stage a playground, which it kind of is, then yes, but no. I had to understudy all of the orphans except for Molly and Annie because of the age. So one was too young for me and one I wasn't quite old enough. But I understudied all of the other orphans, like 4 or 5 of them. So when they would get sick, I would have to go on for them and cover their role at the last minute. Usually when I got to the theater at half hour, they would say, oh, yeah, you're on for Kate tonight. Oh, you're on for Pepper tonight. This is Broadway at the Alvin Ailey Theater, which is now the Neil Simon, I believe. So, yes, and it got even more interesting when 2 orphans were sick. And the first time this happened, I was in shock. I said, oh, my gosh, what am I going to do? And he said, well, you're going to do both of their lines, even though they were totally opposite characters. One was sweet and one was Pepper, who was tough. And he said, and you're going to, like, do, because she's more central for most of the choreography, you go there in all the dance routines, and we'll just let that on the end of the line, you know, be free. So I had to do one person's choreography and both of their lines. So it got really interesting.
So you did this quite orphan. I mean, often.
Yes, I did. Yes, I did.
Were you attending regular school at the time?
I was. I was commuting from Pennsylvania, living in Yardley, and working in New York. I believe it was a two-hour train ride with the changeover in Trenton. So, 4 hours a day on the train and still taking my tests and going to school
and
at 8 a.m.
And you have to get up and be in class the next day?
Uh-huh, on time, yes. And I would get home at 12 or 1 a.m.
What a life. Well, you appeared as a swing orphan. You actually got on stage.
A lot, a couple times a week.
Now, we go to the audition. How'd you find out, Aileen, that there was going to be auditions for the lead role in a film version of the Broadway smash musical, Annie?
Well, again, that was just my agent. I was a working actor in New York doing commercials and doing the Broadway show. And a little after I arrived on the Broadway scene, about 2 months in maybe, I had my first audition for the film. My agent just set up an appointment.
Where was the audition?
It was in New York, but because I had an agent, this was a private audition. So I didn't have to do, fortunately, the huge cattle calls that you see
That's
on TV.
That's the word I was going to use. What did you do at that very first audition? Were you required to sing and dance?
I believe I was put on film right away, especially with a lot of the girls, you know, with theater background. They want to see how you are on film. What I remember about that audition, I met the casting director that would eventually choose me with John Huston, as well as become a friend also later in life, Garrison, and he had me pretend that a cardboard box, this is when I learned about the magic of film, I had to pretend that the cardboard box was Sandy, and I had to say a few lines to it and pet it and sing to it. I do remember that, because I was like, oh, wow, that's interesting.
Really?
Yeah.
Talk about a dumb dog, a cardboard box. So that was your first audition.
Yes.
So you avoided the cattle call. Does that mean some other people must have avoided the cattle call as well, doing some private auditions like you did?
Yes. I mean, I think everyone that pretty much had an agent, you know, had special appointments. However, I will say this, because we were just talking about the Broadway show, I did go to the cattle call for the Broadway show. I believe my number was like 350-something. So I actually got the part as a swing orphan.
Swing orphan is a result of a cattle call.
Yes, it's such a horrible name. It really is. But it just shows that there are hundreds of people or sometimes thousands auditioning for one role.
At that first audition, Aileen, do you remember what song you sang to Sandy, the cardboard box?
It was either Maybe or Tomorrow. I can't remember.
I have read that first it was narrowed down to about 9 people.
I auditioned about 5 or 6 times, and before you get down to the 9, this is really interesting. The time that I met John Huston for the first time, amazing director, I wish we're still around, the day that my mom thought I lost the part, and apparently in interviews later he admitted that that's when he realized I probably was going to be Annie, kind of ironic, so don't give up when you have rough auditions out there. I met him in a room, and all he wanted to do, because he had seen all the videotapes of me singing and acting and doing lines, he just wanted to talk to me, like to get to know the person. And I sat in a chair next to him with a table in between, and, you know, he was an older man, and I was a young girl, and he was very sweet, very grandfatherly. He stroked my hand and asked me some questions about my family and music I liked and sports and did I have a dog or a cat, etc. And it might have been like 1 minute he asked me a few questions and said, well, thank you, Aileen. You know, you have a good day. And when I came out, my mom, who had been in the business for years, said, oh, that's nice. You met the nice man and you talked to him. Well, that's nice. And she said in her head, she thought, she's not going to get this one. She's out. And it was the day that John Huston said, I knew that she might be my Annie because I saw that twinkle in her eye. I liked the way she answered the questions.
He didn't let on. He just thought that.
Oh, not at all. I thought we were just having a nice chat. I didn't really understand that audition. It was probably confusing for me, too.
So you were a finalist.
It was 9 first. We spent a week in California being interviewed at breakfast, working with each other, learning choreography, and all the while, it was very much like today's reality TV, they were videotaping us. So there was a week with 9, and that's where they really put us through all the tests. And then we got down to 3. Then that was the real test.
There was nothing, as far as I know, be a consolation prize, although I guess the 2 runner-ups could have been in the movie, too, couldn't they?
Actually, I believe they were. I think we got down to 3. They did say 2 of you will at least be in the film.
And your audition as one of the 3, I believe, is on YouTube.
Yes, it's the locket scene with Daddy Warbucks.
Albert Finney.
Right.
And here's a little bit of that.
You've given me so much already, Mr. Warbucks.
Charles had the paper signed today. It's official.
What is? Mr. Warbucks, when my folks left me at the orphanage 10 years ago, they left a note saying that they'd come back to get me as soon as they could.
Not wearing a nanny wig.
No, you said you were shocked when you saw me with my natural hair color, which actually was a little bit darker even at the time because I had just done a regional theater production as well of King and I, so my hair was a little darker,
well,
but yeah.
In our pre-interview, I said I was shocked. Actually, what I was shocked about was seeing you do that particular scene with dark hair. Are there people to this day that think that your hair in Annie was, in fact, your real hair?
A lot of people do.
Really?
A lot of people honestly do. They ask me, they're surprised it's a wig.
Do you remember the exact moment when you were told you are Annie?
I do, and I was in complete shock. Garrison, this wonderful casting director and later friend that I told you about, sat me down in my hotel room. My mom's, he was going to tell me in a more group way, and my mom said no. You know, she's had like, you know, over 10 auditions for this over a year period. No, I want you to tell her because you guys have the casting relationship. You both worked so hard. You should tell her one-on-one. So my mom left the room, and Garrison started this, like, serious speech. I had a lot of these confusing conversations back in those days as a child. I was like, why is he getting so serious?
Uh-huh.
He said, Aileen, it was a year ago in January we started looking for Annie. And here it is a year later, and we found our Annie, giving this big speech. And I went, oh, who is it? And I gave one of the other girls names. I said, oh, is it her? And he's like, no, it's you.
Oh.
I think the first thing I said, which is also you can find on the internet, I said, oh, my gosh, my brother's not going to believe this. Because my brother, who was 4 years younger, he didn't know what to make of all this. And I said, oh, my gosh, Drew is going to be in shock.
Wow. Well, you got the role. And do you recall the very first scene that was shot that you were in?
It was such a long time ago, I'm trying to think. I know it was in New Jersey. I believe my first scene was with the mansion, which is now Monmouth University, but I believe it was when, how perfect is this, it was actually when I first go to the mansion and meet Daddy Warbucks.
Okay.
So it wasn't like the beginning of the film, The Orphanage.
Right. When you first met him, he wasn't that nice to you.
Well, no, he wasn't. He was the gruff businessman.
Didn't want a girl.
That's true. That's part of it. So, no, he wasn't the nicest, but I do remember that Anne Ryan King, Grace Farrell, was very welcoming and very nice.
More often than not, movies are filmed out of sequence. And speaking of the memorable Orphanage musical scene... It's the hard knock life. And Annie, Aileen, that's putting it mildly. That was just an unbelievable production number, Aileen. Now, you remember how long that took to film and how difficult it was for you? And I understand some of the orphans in that were actually gymnasts, right?
Yes. Actually, several of our production numbers took a while because they were so extensive and so detailed. That's the magic of movies versus the Broadway show, that we could do all those flips and all those cuts away to different people dancing in different sections of the orphanage. So, yes, I believe that took possibly a week, as did other musical numbers. When you have big production like that with many different elements, it can take 3 days to a week.
Well,
yes.
Watching It's the Hard Knock Life, it occurred to me that as you're filming it, if one girl does something wrong, the director has to go, okay, we got to take it again. We got to take it again. Everything has to be perfect, I would say.
True. Luckily for us, though, I remember this about the Annie set in general. I was working with a lot of pros. I was really blessed. As I just told you earlier in the interview, I had a lot of Broadway experience, and so did some of the other girls of theater experience.
Sure.
And the gymnasts were also very good gymnasts. So luckily, it wasn't as tedious as it could have been because people were pretty coordinated. I mean, it was a pretty tight cast all around.
Great.
I have to say.
That's great. But still,
things go wrong and there are little slip-ups, of course.
And here's another important thing. The music had to be recorded prior to you doing the filming.
Exactly. So that was really the first thing that we really did was in the sound studio to do
the
music.
In the studio,
you
had to record all the
correct
numbers. Were there laws limiting the amount of time that you as a child actress could work per day when you were doing the filming of Annie?
Well, that's a good question, and we won't get too much into it to be politically correct, but, you know, because we were a lot of minors, We did work some long hours that probably today are a little bit more strict, we'll just say. I think soon after the filming of that movie, paired with a few others at the time that had a lot of kids in it in the early 80s, they got a little more strict with the laws. But the nature of doing movies, even to this day, being an actor, sometimes you do have to film into the kind of wee hours of the night, or at least 1 or 2 a.m., so that still does happen as an adult or a child. But with children, that can be a tricky thing because that can be very exhausting. However, I was a night owl because I was a Broadway girl, so luckily that, again, worked in my favor.
I'm wondering, like, for example, did they ever say you could only film 4 hours a day because you were a child?
No, I think, like I said, the laws tightened up a little bit after that in
the mid-'80s
or the 90s. But no, we worked some long hours. We had long days. Plus, I was going to school because we had to have
tutoring,
3 or 4
right?
hours of school every day as well.
Now that was tutoring, right?
Yep, but we really did do work. I have a wonderful tutor, also still a friend. I worked with a lot of great people back then.
How could you do this, filming Annie and then doing tutoring? Did you have homework, too?
Actually, the homework, not as much, because that was learning the lines and going to sleep early, but I was tested on things. I kind of did the homework in the class, like she would do some part of teaching and talking and writing on the board and then actually starting to memorize it and doing my own writing, from what I recall. Yes, I was still tested. I had to keep up with the testing from my school. So it was real school, but not too much written homework, because that was learning the lines at 7 or 8 o'clock at night and going to bed.
Of course, every day that you were going to be doing filming, you had to put on that Annie wig. How long did it take to put it on, and was it very comfortable?
Well, no. As I recall, I would get up pretty early. I kind of remember one of the shows that my mother would motivate me, a cartoon I would watch in the morning, which also kind of relates to Rockabilly. I didn't realize how much of your past influences you. I used to watch Josie and the Pussycats.
Oh, sure.
I used to watch that cartoon.
Right.
And I would be on set by 5 a.m., as I recall, or 5:30.
Mm-hmm.
And it took about a good hour in makeup and hair. Even though I didn't have makeup because I was a kid, the wig did take a while just to get perfect, especially when we got into the scenes where it had to be a little more attractive.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when they shortened it after they cut the pigtails off in the orphan scenes, then it was like, I had to look really perfect, especially when the scenes were more when I was meeting President Roosevelt or I was in the party scene. They were very precise about every curl and make it look beautiful. So, yes, it was a process, and the wig was a little hot and itchy.
What if you have an itch, like, right under the wig? You can't scratch it, really, can you?
Well, especially after that hard work that the gentleman did on my hair, he would say, here's a special comb, Aileen, that has these long teeth. You can kind of, aim it and do the itch with this special long comb. And I was like, okay.
Did you know that director John Huston was a legendary Hollywood figure? In fact, that his dad had been one, too, Walter Huston?
No, I had no idea. To me, he was this kind, grandfatherly man that seemed to really know what he was doing. That's all. I remember thinking, wow, he's really smart. Now I know why.
I am now going to mention players that you worked with and ask you for some quick thoughts on each of them. First off, we have this person who you sing to.
Dumb dog, why are you following me? I ain't got a crumb, dog. How about letting me be? I ain't gonna feed you, ain't got a scrap for you, need you. Don't give a rap for you, dumb dog. Dumber than they come, dog. You're the most presuming dog that a human could know.
Well, of course, I'm using the term person loosely, but I do understand that the dog Sandy was so lovable that it was almost like Sandy was a human being. You had a wonderful relationship with Sandy, but there's a few interesting things about Sandy that people might not know.
Well, that's true. So I believe you're referring to the main Sandy, one of four, I believe, that was Bingo. That's the one in that lovely song you just played, Dumb Dog.
Yes.
He was a sweetheart. He was an older male otter hound, I believe was his breed, with long stringy hair and sweet puppy dog eyes, and he was adorable. He was very easy to work with, a gentle soul. So he was the one I bonded with. However, the stunt Sandy that you saw going through the glass when the bomb was thrown in there just for that one part of that scene, and coming down the stairs, running down with all of the soap in the bubble bath when Daddy Warbucks was angry.
Yes.
Her name was Sandy, and she was a very young pup, but she was very good at stunts. But as a young female pup, let's just say that she was a little more difficult to work with. She would kind of pull on her chain a little bit when I tried to control her. And the first time I met her in rehearsals, she might have nipped me on the hand a bit when I tried to feed her.
A little feisty, Sandy. Now, our listeners are wondering, wait a minute. She, he. You mean Bingo was a he, and the dog, who was really named Sandy, was a she?
Yes.
Oh, boy. But you said there were a couple of other Sandys as well?
Yeah, they didn't end up using them because that stunt dog, even though she was a little feisty, as I put it, she was really good at her stunts. They had backups for her in case, yeah. I guess, she got injured or something. So I believe there were two others on hold, but I never met them.
Yeah. And in order to get Bingo to lick you, what did they put on your face?
As loving as Bingo was, and he might, you know, lick me on the side, off camera, to get him to lick me on cue, on a very specific spot on my face, they put wet Alpo dog food on my cheek at a certain moment, so he would lick me on cue. Yeah, so for that moment, maybe Bingo and I didn't bond so well, because that was pretty disgusting.
You didn't accidentally eat any of that, did you?
Oh, I definitely did not.
And next up, we have a very young girl by the name of Toni Ann Jasandi. She played Molly, and she was only 7 years old.
She was a baby.
You bonded very well with Molly, I believe.
Yes, we had that cute stuff,
Tony, together. Tony. And then there was a guy who had a very imposing figure. Sadly, he has passed away. We're talking about the actor Jeffrey Holder, and he played
Punjab. He was wonderful. I mean, you have to remember, again, this goes back to the Broadway roots I was talking about. You know, this is an ex-Broadway gentleman for many years doing his choreography as well as performing. So he was just very magical. I mean, I know he played a magical character, but I remember that about his spirit. I remember as a child looking at his eyes, and they were so sparkly and just full of fire and fun and creativity. Yeah. He was fun to be around.
Now we go to a couple of people who, well, off screen they were fun to be around, but on screen they weren't very nice. And they were two of the three people singing this song.
Jesus Christ, Jesus Christ,
Jesus Christ,
and He is the key.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Yes, sir.
Jesus Christ,
we'll let the blood lie. The lady loves life.
We have Tim Curry as a lowlife named Rooster Hannigan, and we have Bernadette Peters, who plays another lowlife, his girlfriend, whose name is Lily St. Regis, and they eventually kidnapped you.
Yes, but bad people. They were bad people.
Bad people, but good people in real life, right?
Yes.
You must have enjoyed working with Tim and Bernadette.
That's what's so funny. It's funny when you're talking about their characters, and as you call them, lowlifes, because in real life, they could not have been more the opposite, honestly, both of them. From Bernadette on the first day on the set with me, giving me a beautiful heart-shaped pillow with potpourri inside it and lace as a gift. I still have it to this day. And she was like that throughout the filming. So from that to Tim Curry, who I did not know from all of his things from the past and his Rocky Horror, had no idea about his background. He was the sweetest man, and he was so upset when we were filming those, which I know we'll talk about later, bridge sequences.
Oh, yeah.
He could not have been more helpful protecting me and making sure that he wasn't pulling me too hard and are you okay and asking the crew to make sure I was safe if there was something that was slippery, like very protective.
Next we have Anne Reinking. She played Grace Farrell, who was the secretary to Daddy Warbucks.
She was awesome, and I think you can really see our friendship and our bond in the scene when we do I Think I'm Gonna Like It Here.
Pick out all your clothes.
Blue is her best color.
No, red, I think. Your bath is drawn by Mrs. Greer.
Soup.
No, bubbles, I think.
Annette comes in to make your bed.
The silk?
No, the satin sheets, I think.
I think I'm gonna like it here.
The swim. tennis court is in the rear.
I never even picked up a racket.
What? Have an instructor here at noon.
Oh, and get that Don Fudge fellow if he's available.
I think I'm gonna like it here.
She's another Broadway gal dancer with that sparkle in her eyes. It shows on the film, and she was like that in real life. And actually, Anne was very funny. When we would have breaks in the car in the Duesenberg for the Let's Go to the Movie sequence,
yes,
she would really tell a lot of funny jokes. And I remember, like, they were specifically of a genre of mad Italian scientist jokes.
Wow.
And I just remember one of the punchlines of her joke, but I forget the rest of it, but it was somehow a frog with cut-off legs, and she'd be like, frog no jump. she was hilarious in between takes. I just remember that twinkle in her eye and that she was very funny. And Anne was so sweet to me. I got a lot of nice gifts that I still have to this day. I admired her engagement ring back then. It was a sapphire in the middle and two diamonds. Even though it's not my birthstone, I love sapphires. And she actually gave me a mini replica of her ring for my birthday on the set. Beautiful. With a
wow.
sapphire and two diamonds, which I still have.
And now we have Albert Finney, who played Daddy Warbucks. And, of course, he came across initially as being very gruff, but he was such a softy in the end. He wanted Annie so much. Oh, Aileen, I better do this. Spoiler alert, ladies and gentlemen. If you haven't seen the film, don't listen to my next 10 seconds. He eventually got Annie. Yes.
He did, he did. He was such a sweetheart, and we've remained friends as well. I can remember from my screen test, I remember my mom saying, just look in his eyes and you'll know how to say your lines. It's so true. Not only is he a phenomenal actor, but again, in real life, he's really funny. He's got a wicked sense of humor.
Really?
And yeah, he's really, really funny. He tells funny jokes too. Not mad Italian scientist one, but he has a whole British wit. He's hilarious. He was so kind to me, and not only would he tickle me under the knees to wake me up in that same Duesenberg, because we had to, like, wait for the cameras to make the shot better for 20 minutes, so not only would he tell jokes, he would tickle me under the knees, and he would play games like I'm going to the supermarket to keep my brain working. Like, he had all these techniques to keep child actors, you know, alert on the set from exhaustion. And he took my whole family after the London premiere, including Grandma. I had to hold down the fort. To an Italian restaurant in London, and we closed the restaurant. And he was so much fun, joking around with my brother and my parents and my grandmom. I mean, my grandmother was crying with laughter because he's so funny. And he took our whole family out to dinner, and we had such a great night. He's an amazing actor and an amazing person. And he also gave me my recommendation, which we'll get to later, about college. The one acting that I did do when I wasn't studying other things was to go to London and take a Shakespeare program.
Yeah.
And he actually gave the recommendation of the two schools, and I chose one of the two that were on his recommendation. He ended up keeping in touch with me, even though he was in England, through letters over the years. He's very kind as well.
For the next 5 minutes, you don't have to say a word, because I want you to hear something. Via the magic of a pre-recorded conversation from yesterday, I have a big surprise for you. In fact, it's a big surprise for me, too.
Little girls everywhere I turn, I can see them. Little girls, night and day I eat, sleep and breathe them.
All right, Aileen, here she is, the supervisor of the Hudson Street Orphanage in New York City, Miss Agatha Hannigan.
Hello, my little pig droppings. I never knew she had a first name.
Now you found out. I did a lot of research.
No, it was always Miss Hannigan.
Okay, I am going to give you an introduction that you really deserve. Ladies and gentlemen, we have one of the most beloved show business icons on this planet who played the role of the mean and alcoholic Miss Hannigan in the Annie film? Miss Carol Burnett.
Hello.
Thank you so much, Carol.
Hello, Ronnie.
This is such a pleasure.
Well, thank you.
I have to tell you, I have viewed the movie a few dozen times. I've loved the movie. The one line that you have in that movie, amidst all of the more animated lines, when you're on the bridge and you say, "She may be a mean, rotten little orphan, but I'm not going to let you kill her." You know what that tells me, Carol? That tells me
what?
That Miss Hannigan did have a shred of decency. You are not all bad.
No, she had one shred of decency.
That was it.
That was about it, just one shred.
But Tim Curry, as your low-life brother Rooster, didn't have any shreds.
Right.
Did you actively seek the role of Miss Hannigan, or were you approached by director John Huston or somebody else?
Actually, the producer called me, Ray Stark. He asked me if I would do it, and I had not seen it. I hadn't seen the stage show at all, just for some reason, you know, and I was out in California, and I hadn't seen any of the road companies or anything like that. So I came to it rather in a fresh way, and I remember talking to John Huston, Mr. Huston. I never could call him John. He was a charmer. And I said, "How do you see me doing this?" And he said, "Just cavort, dear, just cavort." That was his direction.
I guess he put a bottle in your hand.
Well, I talked about that, too. I said, you know, maybe a true villain never thinks they're evil. Well, what she thought was that these little orphans were brats, and she was put upon by them. But she never thought she was a bad person. But also, she was forever looking for love and, you know, being stuck there. So most often, people in that position might start to take a drink or two.
Right.
You know, just to soften the pain. And Mr. Huston said, well, let's have her do that.
After John Huston said, cut, when you did one of your mean scenes with Annie and the other little girls, did you ever go up to some of them and hug them to remind them?
Yes.
You were not really the bad person.
Yeah. You know, because they were all little kids. They were 10 years old, 9 years old. I didn't want them to think that, you know, that was me. And
right.
So, yeah, I would hug. I got along great with the kids. And Aileen was a doll. She was an absolute doll. You know, it's tough when kids are in show business. You know, sometimes there are stage mothers or stage fathers that, you know, make them the center of attention constantly, so little egos can be bruised. But none of these kids, I must say, and especially Aileen and her mom, and Aileen was a star. They were very practical about it, and she was not a little bratty diva at all. She was quite the opposite.
Aileen's latest musical project is fronting a rockabilly band, which is called, appropriately enough, Aileen Quinn and the Leapin' Lizards. We're going to be kind of doing the whole full circle with her. Carol, do you have a personal message for Aileen?
Aileen, I just love you, darling. You were such fun to work with, and I wish you every success with Leapin' Lizards. I think it's a great name.
Any last words from you, Miss Hannigan?
Not really. I think I've done her enough.
Okay.
Wow. That's pretty special.
Oh,
I'm so glad you captured that and surprised me with that, because that's how amazing she is.
She said the last time she saw you in person may have been when you were in Peter Pan.
I think so, too. Yes, she made it a point to come backstage and say hello to me and get away from all the paparazzi. Yes. That was really lovely what Carol just said. Carol, oh my gosh. You always have my back. I love how Carol, from day one on the set, was protecting me when we did the bridge scene. It's funny that you guys talked about that, how her character only had a little shred. But Carol has so much shreds of love for people and so easy to work with. I mean, and from the bridge scene when she covered up the hole that was there and said that she wouldn't even continue with the filming with me, you know, because she had more clout than, say, I or my mom had. You know, she said, no, I'm not continuing with this scene until you cover this hole where I could have slipped where the bridge started. From that moment to playing speak and spell with me between takes to keep up my education and, again, keep me active on the steps, and just the lovely person that you are all the time, and you come see me in all of my theater productions and make it a point to come backstage, like in Peter Pan. It means a lot to me, and from someone as talented as you are, that especially the older I get, I realize how special and lucky I am to have had you in my life. It means a lot to me.
Carol's going to love hearing what you just said. As for the bridge scene, it looked like it was a very dangerous scene to film. Was it dangerous?
It was. It honestly was. I mean, of course, they're not going to let me get completely injured, but there were some risks.
You were actually in possible jeopardy.
Well, slightly. Here's the situation. This is why Carol did speak up for me. That hole I was talking about, the real bridge is actually nearby one of the towns where I lived for 10 years, Hoboken, New Jersey, but it's not in Hoboken.
My grandma lived in Hoboken.
I think it's easy. We have so many places in common where we've lived.
I know.
I think it's kind of Kearney, New Jersey, or Newark. It's somewhere in the middle of, you know, Hoboken and then the rest of Jersey. But anyway, that bridge to this day is still sticking up straight. It's very tall. And so when we first pulled up to the bridge, I assumed they meant I was going to be hanging from a bridge, like you would think. A bridge goes, you know, horizontal.
Yes.
But this was vertical. So it's still to this day stuck in that position, and they really did want me to climb up a story of the real bridge.
Uh-oh.
And it was night shooting. It was hard to see. Let's just say that the water below in that area of New Jersey is not particularly clean. There's a lot of factories. So there was a guy in a boat. So that was where Carol stepped in, and they said, oh, there's a little hole there where she has to climb up with her short legs, that first rung of the railroad bridge. Mm-hmm. But don't worry, there's a guy in a boat, and he'll fish her out. You know, he'll get to her quickly if she falls.
That really assured you, didn't it?
Yes. Yeah, my mom didn't really like that comment so much. My mom was a real mom, and she was like, yeah, that's not going to work for me. But she was just a mom, and that's when Carol stepped in and said, no, I will not follow her up the bridge or start to until you cover that.
So,
she really helped out a lot. And then when we went to the studios a couple months later in California, the other bridge was pretty scary, too. It was only 2.5 stories, but I really did hang off of that. And they had a guy on the side that if my arms got tired would lift me up.
So there were actually two bridges.
For the close-ups, when they get in close with my face, and I think there's still shots that are taken that are on the internet where my arms look like they're really stretching.
They use a different bridge for some of the other ones?
Yeah, they use those shots for the close-ups of me crying and hanging. And you can tell, you can see that my arms are really at their maximum muscle. Cause you can see all the veins in the muscles, even as a 10-year-old, because I was actually dangling.
You were dangling, and then Punjab rescued you.
Right, then that's where they cut away to him and Tim Curry flipping me up and trying to grab me, and then Punjab coming. Then we go back to the real bridge near Kearney, New Jersey, and that's where Punjab actually came down in a helicopter along with stuntmen. Yes. But also I should point out, I would like to give credit to Bobby Porter, who was my stuntman for the rest of the bridge. This man who I believe was in his early 30s, who had a wife and kids, God bless him, actually climbed all the way up that bridge and got picked up by the real helicopter in the distant shots. That was a man that risked his life to do stunt work.
And we must point out that during the filming of Annie, nobody was injured. Is that correct?
Thank goodness, no.
Okay.
Another film at the same time did have worse fates, but no. On Annie, we might have had a few bruises, all of us, probably including Carol, falling down drunkenly and me flipping into the laundry basket, but nobody was seriously injured. Nothing major.
Now, you mentioned during the pre-interview there was a big scene filmed very early in the morning.
The party scene, ironically the most festive scene, with the Big Apple Circus in the background. We had a lot of night shoots. Yeah. Luckily, I'm a nighttime girl.
Well, why did they have to film it so early in the morning? Couldn't they have filmed it at 8 o'clock at night?
I'm not sure why, but I remember it was a very late night. But the Big Apple Circus certainly kept me motivated with the fire jugglers and everything going on around me.
Oh, I'm sure. And there were no stunt aliens, were there? In other words, you did all your own stunts in the movie?
Yeah, I did. Now that I think about it, no. I mean, I don't even recall the stand-in. I might have had one that I don't remember. But as far as all of the stunts, no, I really flipped into the laundry basket. Like I said, the only stunt person would be Bobby that went all the way up the bridge in the helicopter.
I was very impressed when you flipped into the laundry basket. I'm saying to
myself. Well, thank you. That took me a week or so of gymnastic lessons. I had to learn
that.
That's
what I was wondering, if you actually had to take a lesson to learn how to.
I did. I had a little coaching for that. I had all the
fabulous
dance training, but as my mom will attest to, I'm definitely not an acrobat.
My favorite scenes include the ones where you put your dukes up. One against the boys.
Yes.
And then there's at least one or two against the girls.
Right. Well, that's a little story, too, because John Huston was a boxer. So So that was pretty funny because I was definitely a girly girl. I liked sports. I liked to play kickball with the boys, but I was athletic. But I was not tough, definitely not tough. And I always had long nails. I still do to this day. So the whole girly side of me, that went against that. I can remember John Houston yelling in the background on takes, "Harder! Harder! Hit him harder! He's a strong guy. He can take it." So he encouraged me to just let him have it.
You enjoyed so much working with John Houston, it's so obvious.
I really did. He was like a second grandfather to me. I mean, my grandfather, he's passed now, is a very lovely person as well. And they were kind of similar. We had a special bond. Absolutely did, as well as with Carol. I'm glad she remembers good memories, too.
When you sang Tomorrow in the White House, you sang it, at least in the beginning, a cappella. There was no instrumentation. Were you told to sing it a certain way, or did you just have a total freedom as far as how you wanted to do it?
In that scene, that was a Mr. Houston actor-director choice to just make it more intimate and make it a more actor moment. And then we, of course, as a group, I rev them up and we break into song. But he wanted that first part, I believe, to be a little special,
yes,
a little softer.
So it was very different, so to speak.
Yes, very unusual for Tomorrow, yes.
Just thinking about tomorrow, clears away the cobwebs and the sorrow. Till there's none. When I'm stuck with a day that's gray and lonely, I just stick out my chin and grin and say, oh, the sun'll come out tomorrow, so you gotta hang on till tomorrow. Come what may, tomorrow, tomorrow, I love ya, tomorrow, you're only a day away. The sun'll come out tomorrow.
Saying Oliver, at the board of your commander-in-chief.
There'll be sun.
Eleanor.
With a day that's gray and lonely, I just stick out my chin and grin and say, everybody, come with us to
Are there any Annie outtakes that are available anywhere? I mean, talking about bloopers type of thing.
I'm sure there are. I have no idea where they are. I'm not the technology person.
Yeah.
I'm not saying there weren't any mistakes or things that went wrong on the set or something falling. But overall, seriously, I remember doing a lot of one and two takes. We had a really tight cast. We really did. We had a lot of Broadway people. You have Anne Ryan King, myself with the Broadway. You have Bernadette Peters. I mean, Jeffrey Holder, so you had, you know, four or five Broadway people right there, and we're not used to getting too many takes, so we didn't do a lot of takes for things that were especially smaller scenes. Production numbers would have been the most challenging.
Well, I think they have to do takes for different camera angles. That's not just because
they do, but we didn't do a lot. I do recall that, and I recall talking about that with John after the filming of the movie. And something else I didn't tell you either about Mr. Houston, which is very interesting. It's just like Carol coming to see me in shows, which I really appreciate. John invited my whole family to his private cove in Mexico after the filming for 1 week. And that was really amazing, which maybe, again, led to things later that we're going to talk about with my love of another language.
Yes. What about the merchandising? I seem to recall your likeness was on just about everything. There was an Annie, Aileen doll. There were lunch boxes, sticker books, other things. How'd you feel about all that?
Well, Well, it was pretty strange to go back to school and people have your lunchbox and little mansions, like you're playing Barbies, but it's like your character's mansion.
Yeah.
It was a little surreal.
I mean,
it's pretty cool.
It was your face. It was your image.
It was. As a matter of fact, I wasn't a very good candidate for that doll that does look the closest to me. They tried to do one of those plaster moldings. Say I wasn't very comfortable with that. I got a little claustrophobic, so they got kind of a half mold. That's why it looks pretty close to my face, but not quite. I think I got halfway through the process. I started to panic. But yeah, so everything from molding my face to make a doll to stickers
tremendous.
And lunch boxes
fabulous.
And plates and you name it.
Obviously, the Annie experience was a wonderful one for you. Unfortunately, life is not always a bed of roses, as you found out shortly after you completed the filming. You broke your elbow in a bicycle accident.
Yes.
Did that cause you to miss any major Annie activities, such as
Well, it did for the U.S., unfortunately. It didn't affect Europe, but it definitely affected the domestic American tour. So after a film is released, as it's still to this day, you go around and promote it, so I wasn't able to do the U.S. tour. I think I just did a couple of cities, and I think there might even be a picture. I think I recall Dallas, Texas, and my arm is still in the sling or the cast.
Wow.
So I only got to do, like, the last couple of cities because in the first few weeks I was still healing, and they didn't want to take a risk. So I think I caught the end of the American tour. But I did get to go to Europe and meet Prince Philip and the Pope in Rome.
Pope John Paul II, I assume, right?
Yes.
That's who it was.
Who is now a saint. 13 countries and 6 continents. I was able to do that. And I believe that London premiere was the first. And I remember having physical therapy in the tub of this really fancy hotel. And that's where I did the movements.
And how many U.S. presidents did you meet?
I didn't meet any presidents. What's up with that? I have not.
FDR doesn't count because that was only a character.
Exactly. No, I mean, in my mind I did, but no, I really haven't met any U.S. presidents. What a shame. I have to work on that in this next chapter of my life. I didn't actually speak to the president, but I'm saying for the diplomatic children at Christmas. I went to Washington, D.C., and I met Mrs. Reagan, and she was lovely. And apparently her favorite color is red. So she was wearing a red dress, and I was wearing a red dress.
Yeah. Okay, now what is your favorite color?
Blue.
Yeah.
So it's really funny because in Annie, I believe one of the lines both in the play and the film, Cecile says, blue is her favorite color. No, red, I think. And actually, it's blue.
When you were done filming Annie, what about your old friends? Did they greet you and have a big party for you or anything? Was there any big event?
There was no big event, but it was really funny that after doing the film, I was very close to my classmates and friends at Greenon Academy. It was really strange when my best friend, about a week after being back in school, asked me for my autograph.
Oh, wow.
And I had gone to her sleepovers and hung out with her, and I said, you don't really want my autograph, do you? And she said, I think I do. I think it's going to be valuable.
So did you put Annie on the autograph?
No, I think I signed it my name, but I just did my little face that I always do, my cute little Annie face, but I signed it Aileen, probably with an X and an O, because she was my buddy.
And by the way, the Annie soundtrack album went double platinum, selling more than 2 million copies. We're going to move to 1983, which is the year after Annie. You put out an album called Bobby's Girl.
Well, Bobby's Girl was with Columbia Records. I was still under contract with Columbia Films for 7 years, which a lot of people maybe don't know, to make other Annie movies. And for whatever reason, they rejected the scripts or the directors, so it didn't work out. But I was able to make this album with Columbia Records with the very famous and amazing Gary Klein. It was really fun because it was kind of a modernized version, supposedly, of a lot of 50s and 60s hits. That was really fun, one of them being Bobby's Girl.
Originally a hit for Marcy Blaine.
Yes.
In fact, Gary Klein and a gentleman named Hank Hoffman wrote the song. We're going to listen to a piece of your version of the title cut from the album, Bobby's Girl.
When people ask of me, what would you like?
I read somewhere that there's just about 12 copies of that album in existence right now, and it's very rare.
Yes, it is.
My friend has a copy. I told him, put it on eBay. Get a few $1,000 for it.
Wow. If it goes for that, I'll be amazed. Wow. Yeah.
Now, in addition to Annie and the Burt Reynolds film we mentioned, were you involved in other films?
I was under contract, so there's a big gap between the age of 10 and 16 or 17 when I was released from my contract. So there were things I had to turn down during that time. So the one that really came to be after all that time off, so to speak, in Hollywood's eyes, I did The Frog Prince. It's one of those lovely fairy tales where she kisses the frog and he turns into be a handsome prince.
Did the Disney Channel air that one?
They did air it a lot. They somehow picked it up, but I did not film it with them. It was not a Disney project, but they did seem to like it and air it on their channel, which was very nice. And it was a beautiful piece with a female director, Jackson Hunsicker, and I had a great time. Because I was under contract and I was turning down films and sitcoms, the one film that I was able to do was The Frog Prince. So then after that, because, you know, once you're out of sight, out of mind in Hollywood's eyes, so to speak, the theater, my original roots, embraced me back right away. So when I was 17, which was a very interesting age to play this role, I played Harpo Marx in A Day in Hollywood and A Night in the Ukraine as one of my first shows back in action.
You played Harpo Marx?
I sure did. I played like a 33-year-old man as a 17-year-old high schooler.
And you didn't have to memorize any lines?
Well, not for that part of the show. The first half, we have some lines and we're ushered in a movie theater, but then we go into the movie, and yes, I become Harpo Marx. And as you can see from me being a talker, that was actually one of my most challenging roles I've played to date, because I was quite the chatty teenager and I had to be completely silent for the second act. And I had a lot of props that I had to coordinate too. And as people that are listening to this, maybe they've worked with me in some of these off-Broadway, Broadway theaters and regional theaters know over the past 30 years, props are not my strong suit either. So to have to do the comedic timing with no words and with various props, it had to be timed just perfectly, like rubber chickens and God knows what I pulled out of my coat. So the Marx Brothers, that was a challenging role.
I would have loved to have seen it.
It was actually in Pennsylvania. That was one of my regional shows at good old Bristol Riverside Theater.
And you were 17. That was a very good year. Well, I'm sure that you were a great Harpo Marx, but I'm certainly no Sinatra. Well, that certainly got you back to your theater roots, so to speak.
That led to a string of shows, and actually, my mother did have a friend, but I still had to audition for him, who had a theater in North Carolina, Fayetteville. And I auditioned for Lee because he wanted me to do Bye Bye Birdie. That was a really fun show to do.
What role did you have in Bye Bye Birdie?
I got to be Kim, so I got to, you know, be in love with the stud puppet, but then go with, you know, the good guy that was right from my neighborhood. So that was really a blast. And then I ended up doing a series of shows in North Carolina every summer. So I was a regular, you know, education was very important. This was in my late teens, and I did a few other shows. I did Shenandoah, which is a beautiful show about war and loss and love. I played Jenny, and I got to shoot a shotgun. That was kind of fun, a fake shotgun. Yeah, but it still had the pop. It had little blanks. And I also got to do, in that time, I did a bunch of shows. Oh, well, this is funny. We didn't talk about that. I skipped over this. While I was still under contract, I was able to do, maybe because it was Annie, I did a version of Annie when I was 15 with Hart Presnell down there in North Carolina. So I got to work with him, and then flashing back to the Broadway days, that was John Shuck. So I got to work with some great Daddy Warbucks all around. I've been blessed. That was one of the many shows I did, but I did do others.
How old can you be and still play Annie? Because you said you were about 15?
Yeah.
So here you play it in the film, you're 10 years old. Could you look 10 years old when you're 15?
You know what? I think it depends on the girl. I'm very petite, as I still am, but I have some curves now. But I was a late bloomer, let's just say, physically, and so it worked.
You were working on Broadway as a swing orphan. We talked about that earlier. Was Andrea McArdle in the show at that time?
No, she wasn't. Actually, Allison Smith was Annie.
Andrea had left.
Way before that. Oh, yeah. I'm at the end of the Annies. Andrea was the first. We've met over the years because we both do musical theater. We've crossed paths, both touring and being on Broadway, off Broadway. So I know her personally, but I've never worked with her professionally. Not yet.
Let's continue with the theater. You've probably done a few hundred shows.
I've done a lot. So basically what happened was I did a bunch of shows in a row in North Carolina and also in Pennsylvania and a few other states. And then that's when I started to decide, okay, my mom was a school teacher and a very good school teacher, and of course we had like a very, you know, lovely, stable family. So I saw that. So I started to say, well, maybe I'll take a break from the business now, even though I was just getting back into it, and maybe I'll just go to college and do other things. So then when I went to college, of course, what's natural to go with actors, and many actors have done this, is politics and social work. So I was a poli-sci minor, and I decided for Spanish to be my major, and I don't know whether that was the influence of going to Mexico at age 10 and a half after filming with John Huston, or various Latin countries I had traveled to and had good experiences on my tour. I met the princesses of Spain, so I don't know what the influence
what
was.
What college were you attending?
I went to Drew University.
New Jersey, I believe.
Yes, and this is when we had moved to New Jersey already after Pennsylvania.
You majored in Spanish. You were also a member of a Spanish Honor Society. What was that?
Yes, which to this day my mom laughs because everybody knows that everything in college is pi, of course.
Yes.
You know, pi, pi, pi. But when you're in the Spanish Honor Society, it's Sigma Delta Pi.
Okay.
So it's pi. So, yes.
It's a different pi. It's not like pi r squared.
It's a different one. And they pronounce it differently, too. Pi.
I always figure, who cares about pi? Just use 22 sevenths and everything is good. No, but it's a good thing I'm not a scientist.
Yes.
Anyway, you are fluent in Spanish, right?
Yes. And my most amazing experience was actually during that time when I was majoring in Spanish, I got to go abroad to Chile for a semester. And that was one of the most amazing experiences in my life because besides touring with Annie and promoting a film, which can be a rigorous schedule, and you get to see a little bit of the country, but not too much. This was when I was really living for 6 to 8 months in a country with a family, only speaking Spanish, and going to their post office, eating their food, and just living the life of the culture, taking their public transportation, and really seeing how other countries live. So that was really an eye-opener for me.
You were an exchange student.
Yes, so I did this semester abroad. And kids, if you can afford it, if you have that opportunity, absolutely do it. I recommend to anyone. And if you can do it in another language, whether it's Italian or Spanish or whatever it is, Russian, anything, do it. Because I think when you travel abroad, it really changes you. You grow, start to appreciate the things that you have, but then you see other things that maybe you're missing. You learn a lot about yourself and the world.
Being fluent in Spanish, did you ever record tomorrow or anything else in that foreign language?
Not yet. No, I have not actually recorded anything in Spanish yet.
What'll it be? The sun will come out mañana?
They have versions of it. It is mañana, yeah.
How long were you at Drew University?
I graduated from there. I did do a year in California before choosing Drew. Actually, I have this whole confusion between the coasts. I love both the West Coast and the East Coast, so I can never choose to this day. But I ended up at Drew. Of course, my roots are on the East Coast, so I was there for 3 years.
You did several shows after leaving college.
Yes. Yeah, so then, of course, as always happens in life when theater and acting and singing and dancing are in your blood, three generations worth, I was going to go into more peace works. I was going to join the Peace Corps. That was the plan. I had an interview through a connection at the UN for the Tuesday a week from this date. And on a Tuesday, my agent called me up after patiently waiting for 4 years while I went through this college phase. And she said to me, Aileen, I got this audition for Fiddler. I know you're really Irish. And then she was very Jewish and said, I think you could play Little Havala. What do you think? You want to give it a shot? It's Theodore Bekele. He's an amazing theater actor for years. Why don't you go for it? I said, okay. And I didn't really take it seriously. It was my first audition in 4 years. And I got the part later that day. So I canceled my UN interview and I took it as a sign from God that I was meant to keep.
In other words, you were not meant to be the next Shirley Temple who became an ambassador.
I thought I was, but I guess not.
Did you ever meet Shirley Temple, by the way?
I never did. I would have loved that, but no, I didn't.
I'm sure she knew about Annie, though. She knew about Aileen Quinn.
I think we know about each other,
Everybody in the country knew about Aileen Quinn playing Annie. And this was the Broadway national tour of Fiddler on the Roof. And the role you played was the milkman, Tevye's daughter.
Little Havala, yeah.
And then after Fiddler,
I did a couple of off-Broadway shows, and one of them was kind of based on the story of Aladdin. I did Dream Stuff.
You played the princess in Dream Stuff?
Yeah, so I played a princess twice. I've been blessed to play a
princess.
Kind of funny, right?
You never played Snow White.
Actually, she's my favorite classic Disney princess. I love Snow White.
Well,
but no, I haven't played that yet, but I don't know if my Snow White days are behind me now.
Well, I don't know if you're going to have time because you have another pursuit we're going to leap to a little bit later on. And I told Carol Burnett all about it, and she was very impressed.
Yes.
And that's keeping you busy right now.
And you did plenty of other shows as well.
Some of the other shows, just to give you a list, Peter Pan, I did do that. I played Toodles and Jane. I played a lost boy, mm-hmm. as well as Jane at the end, Wendy's daughter, mm-hmm. as well as covering Wendy, and I went on for that a lot, as well as covering Peter. But I did not have to go on for Peter because Kathy Rigby is an Energizer bunny. She didn't take off too much.
Did you have to fly?
I did.
Were you nervous about flying?
I was. I do have a little bit of a fear of heights, but I have to say that the guys that were on the crew, I really trusted. So after working with them in rehearsals and knowing that they were trustworthy even to go on tour with, I did feel safe with the crew we had. Yeah, that was a little scary, but then it's really exhilarating.
You're pretty high, aren't you?
You sure are. I mean, you really get a good view of the entire theater and the upper scenery. I mean, I think everybody should fly at least once in their life. It's pretty cool.
No thanks. Okay. I don't know if I really want to do it. I'll think about it.
Okay.
That was on Broadway, right?
Yeah, we sat down on Broadway and we also went on tour.
You did the unsinkable Molly Brown playing the role.
Oh my gosh, how did I forget that? Thank you for reminding me.
Yeah.
That was another good role I did. Yes,
you
the
played
unsinkable Molly Brown.
Not to be confused with the orphan Molly. This was a different Molly.
Correct. Yeah. Debbie Reynolds' role.
Tammy Grimes originated it on Broadway.
That's true, and I heard she was amazing. That's
amazing,
true.
And then Debbie Reynolds was absolutely amazing. Meredith Wilson, the guy that wrote The Music Man, did the unsinkable Molly Brown.
That surprises me. I did not know that he wrote Molly Brown. That actually shocked me.
For how long did you play Molly?
I did that for a couple months in regional theaters. That was a very physical role. A lot of fun to do. But doing that belly up to the bar boy scene, I recall a few bruises in that scene because we really went there. I was still very young and bouncing around that stage and dancing and doing all those dragging feet and being lifted up on the bar. Oh, yeah.
The best known song from the Unsinkable Molly Brown, I believe, is I Ain't Down Yet.
Yes. And that was a blast to do, too. And I have two brothers in that I was wrestling and tumbling with on the stage.
Yeah.
Yep. So very physical role. That was probably, besides Peter Pan, I'd say Peter Pan and Molly Brown were the most physical roles I've done. And I actually did them back-to-back. And off-Broadway, I also did another Jewish show, this little Irish girl. I did Yiddle with a Fiddle, which is based on kind of a Yentl kind
and
of
let me guess, you played Yiddle?
I sure did. I was little Yiddle with her fiddle.
Did you actually play a fiddle?
No, I didn't. We kind of did that through dance. We had a beautiful choreographer, and she let me
Yiddle
do
with
beautiful.
A fiddle.
What's really interesting, Ronnie, and it's so true, is that not only in the same year that I did Yiddle with a Fiddle at the American Jewish Rep, did a lot of my Jewish friends from New York, and they had to put on brogues and everything, they were hired at the same time by the Irish Rep a few blocks away. It was hilarious. Mm. All my Jewish friends were in the Irish play that fall, and I was in the Jewish
play. You're in the Jewish play.
We laughed about that, because I've always had many Jewish friends, so
well,
we cracked up, because we reversed, we switched, but I think that's good.
This was great, but you'll learn about the other side, the other culture.
Exactly. It's really funny, though. One of my songs, I did it fully in Yiddish, and I did pretty good with the Yiddish. And my friends had to learn the Irish accent and do the brogue, so it was hilarious.
But when you did it in Yiddish, you're not fluent in Yiddish.
I'm not. But you know what I still remember from Oy Mama? Oy Mama, bin ich verliebt. Oy Mama, bin ich verliebt. Un klezmer jingle, Mama getreier, licht mir nur in Sinn. Ich wein und lach und weiß mit Mama, oi welter welt ich bin.
I think that was close.
We could use this as a mystery artist sometime. Who is this singing that? And nobody in the world would know it unless they hear our interview. You were in a show, Saturday Night Fever, which was based on a movie, right?
That was one of my favorite roles because I told you earlier in the interview, dance was always my first love. Now it's singing and dancing hand in hand, or maybe singing more. But to be able to do like the disco era piece, I got to play Annette, which was kind of against the way they were casting me for a while, even though I was always working in theater.
Yes.
I either went from playing boys, as you can see a lot, from, you know, Yentl, like the Yiddle with a Fiddle, where I dressed as a boy but was really a girl, to Harpo Marx, that Peter Pan, where I played Toodles.
Gosh.
You can kind of see a theme there. And then all of a sudden, and this ties back into Annie, ironically, I almost didn't get the part in Saturday Night Fever because Arlene Phillips, who was a wonderful choreographer for Annie, with the great Joe Layton, they worked together. Arlene was the choreographer for Saturday Night Fever on Broadway as well as the tour, which I ended up doing. And she almost didn't want to give me the part at first because she said, you know, Annette's kind of the underdog.
Mm-hmm.
She's so vulnerable. You know, it's kind of heavy, and I just see you as so confident. I don't think you can understand this character and think, if I can't have you, I don't want nobody, baby. And you know what? Through the audition process for that, 4 or 5 auditions, both in L.A. and in New York, the final callback, she saw me on opening night in Chicago on tour, and she said, oh, my God, Aileen, you were, like, born to play this role. And I said, I tried to tell you. She had no idea, and it was a breakthrough for me acting-wise. It was a more dramatic role, and it was kind of the role that brought all three of my talents together in one show.
Fantastic.
You know, extreme dance, heartfelt singing, and a completely different style of acting.
What was the character Annette in Saturday Night Fever?
She's the one, I mean, from the movie. She's the one that loves Tony so much, but she doesn't get the guy. I had played a lot of strong characters, even in Shenandoah. I was the one defending my papa's property with the rifle gun and defending the ranch or the farm. I played a lot of heroines. That's why she was in shock to cast me as that, but she's like, you play a really good victim too. She had no idea.
Obviously, you didn't want to get tied up in one single thing. You kept looking for new projects, and
of course,
you decided
to diversify.
And you decided to study Shakespeare.
Yes.
And he was pretty good. He was a pretty good
writer. He was a pretty good writer. That was a good choice.
And that led you to London, England.
Yes, and that was one of the programs that Albert Finney had suggested. I was between two schools, and one was, of course, a more famous one, but he said, if you really want to incorporate, which I always have throughout my career, a little bit of music with the acting, then I recommend Lambda, which is the London Academy of Music and Dramatic Arts. He's like, I know you want to study Shakespeare very seriously, but if you want music and even music as part of the acting piece, he's like, I highly recommend Lambda. So I did choose that, and I went there for the summer, and I did Viola in A Twelfth Night, and I did Celia. That was probably the first time they cast me, again, just like Saturday Night Fever. Against type, so to speak, I played kind of the sarcastic Celia in As You Like It. So I got to try my Shakespeare chops in the summer, so that was kind of cool, too.
And you did a show called Creature. Another off-Broadway project.
I wish that had gotten picked up. I think they've tried to make so many versions, even on Broadway. So with Dracula, it was not Dracula, but what they've been trying to do on Broadway for years and have never done it successfully, and I think this was a predecessor to that, is both really good stories of Frankenstein and Dracula, because they were so successful in films. But I think when they transfer it to the stage, it doesn't work as well. But this was a piece about being called Creature, Frankenstein, and about how misunderstood he was and what it was like to try to be a human being. So I was the mad scientist wife, Elizabeth, but he didn't treat me very well.
You did. What is this? That was then world premiere.
Oh, that's another thing I'm very proud of, too. Throughout my theater career, there have been different points when I really felt the growth as an actor, and that was another one, because that was just a straight play. And actually, I'm glad you mentioned that was then, this is now, because I finally got to be Irish and use my natural, you know, my people's Irish brogue, finally. And with that one, it was the famous writer, his name is escaping me right now, he was a wonderful in person as well as a writer, from the Abbey Theatre. So he's a famous writer from Ireland, and this was the world premiere of the play in upstate New York, not New York City. But we premiered it.
What role did you play?
I was April Gregory. I met my husband at an AA meeting.
Funny, you don't look like a grandmother.
Oh, my gosh. See, I forgot about so many shows I've done. I've done so many. Yes, yes. And no, I did not play a grandmother. I'm still kind of young.
That was just the name of the show.
I know, I'm teasing you, but a lot of people say that. They're like, who did you play in that?
Actually, Aileen, you played the daughter.
I had three grandmothers. It was kind of a play about people getting older. That was another original musical / play. It was about what grandmothers go through and different types of grandmothers you can be. You know, the party grandma, the one that's baking cookies, and I played the daughter of these three grandmas, the symbolic daughter. Yep.
I have heard that, in a way, you kind of came full circle in Annie. I don't believe you ever played the role of Miss Hannigan.
No.
But, at Theater Aspen, is that in Colorado?
Yes, the famous ski place.
The role you played, Lily St. Regis, that was friend of Rooster, Rooster's girlfriend?
No, I wouldn't say friend. Friend is a nice word. His special friend.
All right,
yes,
whatever to him. You played the role of Lily St. Regis, who was one of the people that tried to kidnap you in the film.
Yes.
Now, all of a sudden, you're a bad guy, I mean a bad girl.
How did that feel?
Actually, you know what? It was really fun for most of the play. It was really fun to do Easy Street, which was actually my second favorite song after Maybe, to tell you the truth. So I loved Easy Street and the scenes leading up to that, which is her famous line. That's why I do remember her name, because she says, I'm named after the hotel. So that's why I remember her name, because she was so dumb.
And as if this is not enough, your resume also includes teaching at the Hudson Catholic Regional High School in Jersey City, New Jersey.
I did.
And you know what the coincidence is? What was the name of the orphanage?
The Hudson Street Orphanage.
Yes. It seems like everything kind of goes full circle in your life.
I must be like a girl that likes to go back to her roots.
I think that
was not even intentional, honestly. That was through a friend of a friend. It's really funny because I didn't even think about that. You're right. Everything comes full circle. I guess I'm a roots girl.
And roots girl, when were you teaching?
That was somewhere in between doing shows and maybe for the second time thinking of pursuing other things. So that came in there in the teaching phase of my life.
What subjects were you teaching?
Well, there, ironically, I was teaching beginner Spanish. So I was actually a legit teacher, but I was also doing drama as well.
Okay.
And before working at Hudson Catholic, I actually worked for many years, and this is my teaching phase of my life, at St. Elizabeth's School in New Jersey. And that I had an ongoing, as well as my mom did, after school acting program. And we did the shows in the spring and Christmas time, so I had been teaching drama for a while and co-directing with my mom, actually, at the school at St. Elizabeth's. So, yeah, so I had a big teaching phase of my life, which also includes during that phase, and again, this is another full circle moment, I went over to Monmouth University because I had such great memories there.
Oh, my gosh, yeah.
And I was an adjunct professor and still am technically, I'm on a major leave of absence, about 5 years worth.
Yeah, I guess that's major.
I was also part of the drama program there. I was teaching theater for non-minors, as well as teaching the film course for acting for TV and film as well.
If a person were to go to, and I'm not suggesting that everybody in my audience take a ride tomorrow, go to Monmouth, you have thousands of people there, but if you did visit Monmouth, would you actually see the room where Annie was filmed, the mansion?
Well, the part that you would really recognize is where you would have to go anyway to probably check in or register. I believe it's Wilson Hall,
yes.
And they have a lot of functions there as well as classes. They have a lot of benefits there. So that's kind of what led me to teaching there, actually.
And that's still the same as it was.
Yes, I mean, you'll notice a few differences, but it's mostly the same. So that you'll see those famous stairs, you'll see that statue, you'll see when I entered, that's where you'll maybe park your car. I don't know if that's a legal parking lot, but the parking lot where we entered with the old-fashioned car, out in the grounds where we did the party scene, it's still all there. Maybe that's what led me to teach there. I'd help them out with a fundraiser. I think I got those magical tingly feelings being in Wilson Hall. So I asked, you know, do you need a professor for any of your courses? And they said yes.
Yep.
And there I was the next year teaching for a couple of years.
You will not see Daddy Warbucks there. I don't believe he's there.
You will not.
Or Annie, for that matter. You're not going to see Annie
there. No, and you would have seen me a couple of years ago, but no, you won't see me now there either.
We're going to actually close the show, believe it or not, with your version of Tomorrow that you did at Monmouth. I figured that would be a good way to close the show.
Yeah.
With your not really favorite song, but you still like it.
I still like it.
It's a good song. One scene that I just recalled, he decides he doesn't like the Mona Lisa, so he takes it down.
Yes, he does. That's very true. He doesn't like her smile. She's a funny smile.
He doesn't like her smile, so he thinks.
That's hilarious.
Have we covered the theater pretty much?
Yes, we did the theater justice, and you even remembered shows I forgot.
Well, Aileen, it's time to get to what you are doing now. I don't mean just talking to me. I mean in terms of your career. It wasn't until relatively recently that you decided to become part of, in fact, the lead singer of, a rockabilly band.
Yes.
And is that because you were so busy with the theater you couldn't do everything? There's only 24 hours in a day.
Between the teaching and the theater and everything I pursued, yes, there are only 24 hours in a day. However, I think the other thing that was pivotal about the rockabilly and especially the songwriting, which we're going to get into in a moment, is, first of all, I moved to California, and I don't know if you know this about California, especially the West Side, West LA, more so than in New Jersey and New York and Pennsylvania. A lot of people still have to this day their classic cars from the 1950s, back in the glory days when the freeways didn't look like they do today. So a lot of people are kind of very nostalgic out here about that era. So I met some people that liked it as much as I did. I met a few musicians 4 years ago.
But you didn't know at the time you moved that you were going to be the lead singer of a rockabilly band.
No, I came here to get back into film and TV.
Okay, all right. But somehow that didn't happen.
Not yet. Not that yet. Will happen too, but not yet.
I think
my life has phases. I have lots of phases. So we're in the musician rockabilly phase.
Well, it's a great phase.
It sure is. So what happened was I met someone who was a neighbor, and noticing all the classic cars, hearing the rockabilly music around, watching on TV, actually, that Rockabilly Women's special, the Women of Rockabilly.
Yes.
I'm so excited that you actually got to talk to Wanda Jackson, one of my heroes. So I saw this special with Brenda Lee and Wanda Jackson, and I was amazed, like, wow, these women, for their time period, were really powerful and wonderful singers and strong women. So it had left an impression. In a long story short, it turns out the neighbor of one of the musicians, it was her ex-husband, but they're still friends, said, oh my gosh, you have an amazing voice. You need to meet my ex. He's about to form a rockabilly band, and they need a female singer. And I said, well, I also love rockabilly. So she said, what a small world. And the next thing you know, we started rehearsing. We put a band together, and we decided to call it the Leapin' Lizards.
How did you come up with that name?
I racked my brain, and somehow that just came to me.
People will laugh. There is something funny about that.
There is, and it's also a very appropriate rockabilly name, too. I don't know why.
It is, and you are a heck of a rockabilly singer.
Thank you.
You told me something in an email. You co-wrote all of the songs on the album, Spin Me. How many are there?
There are 10. We have a few more kind of in waiting, but there's 10 that we chose for this first album, so there are 10.
Now, you told me in your email that your songwriting came about as a result of surgery that you had.
Right, which kind of leads from the distraction from pursuing film and TV, exactly. So this is going to be ironic, too. You're going to laugh. While I was doing Lily, I had a little injury up in Aspen 2 days before we opened. So that was a little shocking, and I didn't know at the time how bad the injury was until I went home after the break. But anyway, long story short, it was one of those freak accidents that was a combination of the stage and my show shoe. And let's just say that I had a really bad surgery.
Knee surgery?
Sure was. It was the ACL, the word that dancers never want to hear. Yeah.
You know, well, this brings us up to a point, that expression, break a leg. Where did that come from? You don't really want a person to break a leg.
No, everybody's been asking me for years, what does that mean? I believe it came from the vaudeville days. Talk about going way back in time.
Wow.
I believe that in those days that the actors or singers, performers, dancers, didn't necessarily get paid because they lined up so many back in those days to go just jump on the stage.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if you broke the leg, like the sight line, like meaning that you got on stage, you weren't just an act waiting in the wings. If you actually broke the leg of the stage, you got paid. You got your $20 or whatever. So it was about the stage, though, not your own leg.
Not your own
leg. Right, about the sight line of the stage, breaking the curtain, the wing. So you want to break a leg. You want to be a paid performer.
I see.
I think.
I will tell you something, Aileen. I will never, ever tell anybody to break a leg. Because with my luck, it would happen.
It will.
And guess who they'd blame? You know.
Ronnie.
Exactly. You had surgery.
Right, and
surgery.
That was kind of a shock because I was auditioning for film and TV and nothing had settled yet,
yes.
But it was going well. And then all of a sudden I did this show and I got injured. And then the most frustrating thing, this very physical person,
mm-hmm.
all of a sudden had to sit on her booty for 2 months and not move. So
believe.
That was not very fun for me. So I think I had all these pent-up emotions and,
right.
and things that I was feeling and time for reflection from my normally hectic schedule. And that's kind of what led to the songwriting. And I had already been hanging around with the band prior to this for about a year.
But you didn't know, in other words, you had been hanging around with the band for a year, but you didn't have really material at that point. You were just
playing. We had, at that time, been doing covers. Exactly.
Other people's hits. So now, while you're, as you say, you're on your booty for 2 months, you also had a pad in front of you, and you were writing down some lyrics.
And an iPad that you could hit voice memo and record.
Everything.
You got it.
Oh! So who knows what would have happened if you didn't have that accident.
You'll find this interesting. Somebody years ago, my mom loves to tell this story because she thinks it finally came to fruition what the lady had predicted. When I was doing Annie, and I think when I went to the New York premiere where I met Nancy Reagan, mm-hmm. I believe that some kind of astrologer or some kind of psychic, held my hand very firmly for a second at the party and said, wow, your daughter's doing really well right now, but she's not just going to be known for her acting. She will be known for that in the future in other projects as well as this, but she's going to be more known for her writing. And for years, my mother filed this away and thought, that's crazy. What does she mean? My daughter does well in English in school. I was very good, especially in English and writing, but she said, what, is she going to write a novel? She's not a novelist. She can't sit still, because I was always a kid that couldn't sit still.
Well, that's true. Yeah.
So she's thinking this means I'm going to write a novel, and for years she couldn't figure that out. And after she heard the first couple of songs that I was writing, my mom actually went, oh my gosh, I get it now. Songwriting.
So interesting. And did you write any of the songs by yourself?
I do. I have songs, but not on this album.
Not on this album.
There will be.
All these are co-writes. You want to give a quick shout-out to the members of the band?
I sure do, and especially my co-writer that I work at his studio, Mr. Tom Murray. He's also the drummer and my background harmonies. And he plays guitar and piano, too. And also the other members of the band, we have Matt Pensabene on stand-up bass. I have Jorge Reyes on saxophone. And John Pajowski. We call him Johnny Pie because it's easier to say.
And what instrument does Johnny Pie play?
Harmonica. And Frank Giffen, last but not least, on lead guitar.
The album is called Spin Me, and the title song is Spin Me.
There's actually two things that went into this song. One of the things was in like the vinyl and the old-fashioned kind of instruments we use to spin records, part of that. But the actual inspiration was when my co-songwriter was out at a rockabilly venue where they swing dance a lot, because, of course, that's why Brian Setzer brought back swing with rockabilly. The girls were particularly good dancers at this club and were actually being flipped up into the air and wore the big skirts with the petticoats, like really, you know, working the dresses. And he said it was just amazing to see these couples in unison spinning and flipping and everything. So he kind of came up with the concept, and then I took that and ran with it, and he helped out too. So there we have Spin Me. Ironically, one of the choruses or verses I wrote, I was actually on the spin cycle exercising like I like to do, and I was actually spinning while I was writing part of the song. And then I had to run up to my iPad.
Bit of Spin Me, and there's one called The Doctor Is In, which seems appropriate since you actually started writing these songs when you were on your booty for 2 months. The doctor came in many times to examine how you were doing.
Yes, he did, and I went to his office many times too, yes. So that song was an idea. My favorite line to say when we play live gigs is, all of you out there in the audience who have had some good healing inside and outside of the doctor's office.
Wow.
So I had a special friend at the time that was definitely helping me through the surgery, which was nice. And also, yes, I had many visits that when you have a serious surgery like that, I had to go to the doctor's office at least once a month for a checkup for about 6 months. So, yep.
So here's a little bit of the song called The Doctor Is In, but you'll have to wait about 45 minutes to see him. That's the way it is with doctors.
Even when they're that's in, true.
My head. He's the doctor of the century, the man of the hour.
I am Ronnie Allen, and talking, I didn't even tell people who I am except at the very beginning of the show, so I'm just going to remind people. I'm Ronnie Allen.
Sure, sure.
Talking to, what did you say your name was?
Aileen.
Annie. This is Annie. Annie Warbucks. Aileen Quinn. And Yiddle with a fiddle.
Don't you love that? I love that I played that role.
Oh,
I wish you could have seen me do that, Ronnie.
Me too, Aileen. We got a change of pace song right now. The first two that you just heard are real kickers. And this one, which is a tad slower, is called Come On Over.
That song came from me, actually. That's a little bit of my Latin influence, from my various studies and travels, as well as I was waiting for my friends to pick me up, and I just started, leaning back, and I had, a little side table, and I just started this rhythm, and I just started singing. And again, thank God for that iPad. I just grabbed it and hit voice memo and went, oh my gosh, I like this. So, yeah, that kind of came to me from a rhythm and a feeling of kind of sultry waiting. And there you have it.
Come on over. I've got exactly what you need. You won't know what I've done to you, boy. So good, boy, you should surrender and just give in to me. I'm gonna take you.
That's a little bit of Come On Over, nice and soft. And now we're going to get nice and loud. Mama didn't raise you right. That's not an editorial comment. That's the next track from the CD that we're going to hear right now.
That song was actually the first one before Spin Me that started the songwriting. This is the chick anthem. I always say when we do our live gigs, this is my spiel before that, and it's true. This song is for all you girls out there. I always say that like those bad boys, and maybe they stayed around too long. So this one was a combination of someone that I met here when I first moved to California and someone from the past. It was kind of a combo of two people, and the idea behind it is not to be insulting to mothers. No, it's just that, maybe some mothers didn't raise their sons right because it's about a guy that doesn't really treat a girl very well. And so that it's probably like a Southern expression, hey, your mom didn't raise you right. You better treat me better. So that's how that came about.
When I met you, you asked me out. That's the only one I did you think I'd put out. No, your mama didn't raise you right. Yeah, she sure didn't raise you right. You're not even worth putting up a fight. You stole my keys, you crashed my car. Did you really think you'd get that far? No, your mama didn't raise you right. Yeah, she sure didn't raise you right. You're not even worth putting up a fight. Well, baby, believe me, when I first met you, I couldn't see right and wrong. You grabbed my hair and you pulled me tight. We keep rocking, baby, all night long.
Okay, I get the message. Mama didn't raise you right. And in contrast, we have the final track on the CD, which is called Believe.
The moms and dads, as well as the kids, will really love Believe. It's something that we need to do these days, a very hopeful song.
Something all of us can use, Aileen.
Kind of a combination of maybe and tomorrow. Right. That was actually the last song that we wrote, So that's kind of, the culmination. Yes.
As I look through the pictures, years gone by,
amazed how we've both come so far. We've been through the desert, we've been through the storm. I still find myself in your arms. 'Cause we believe, 'cause we
I don't merely believe that's a beautiful song. I know it is. Aileen, tell me, how can people get the CD?
If you've enjoyed some of these little pieces of music, it's on our website that we're selling those and some Leapin' Lizards t-shirts as well. Aileen Quinn and the LeapinLizards.com.
And it's L-E-A-P-I-N. There's no G.
Leapin.
Right?
Yes, there's no G.
No G.
It's a Leapin.
Well, Aileen, your career has been truly amazing. You obviously had dreams, and you realized so many of them. And I know there are many Aileen wannabes out there listening to this show. Based on your own experience, do you have any advice to offer them?
Yes. Well, I think what's kind of, you know, pushed me forward throughout my career is that I really love what I'm doing. I think first and foremost, you have to love whether it's dance or playing an instrument or writing songs or acting, whatever it is that you do that's artistic, even sculpting for that matter. If you really love what you're doing, I think that will push you through. That and your training. I definitely recommend lessons. Take your voice lessons, take your guitar and piano lessons, take your dance lessons. So it's a combination of training and the love for what you do. And I think if you have that combination, you'll just continue to grow in your craft and get better and enjoy it more. And, you know, there's going to be times when it's hard. It's hard work, and not everything is going to go perfectly every time, and you're not going to get every role that you want. You could get typed out of roles. But if you really love what you're doing, you're going to grow and you're going to have fun with the roles and the things that you do get.
Aileen, this has been such a joy for me. It's only taken 33 years for me to communicate with you when you were doing Annie, and I was in the town right next door to you. I mean, I knew all about you. The Bucks County Courier Times was my local newspaper.
Yeah.
They did plenty of articles about you.
Sure did.
I was rooting for you when the film came out. I've seen it a couple of dozen times, not all in one night. I saw it a couple of times just to prepare for this show, to refresh my memory. I wish you continued success with Aileen Quinn and the Leapin' Lizards. Hope you come east real soon so I get a chance
to meet
you in person.
Yes.
And with the rockabilly, have you retired from the theater, or is this something you may go back to occasionally doing a theater show in the future?
You know, I've had different phases in my life, but I will never not do any form of performing. I mean, I'm a performer, so whether it's exclusive to music for right now, whether I go back into film and TV, if someone casts me in something, and then go back to the theater, which gave me work for 30 years, I mean, absolutely nothing is off limits.
Could you portray Miss Hannigan?
I think I could in another 10 years. I'm a very young my age, so I think Lily was probably right on target as far as that casting, but maybe in about 10 more years
funny?
I could explore that.
You know what a story that would be? Because I know Patty Duke played different roles in The Miracle Worker. You know, she played the girl, and then she
did that with The Miracle Worker.
Yeah, she did that. And you've already played two Annie roles, actually more than two if we count the Swing Orphans.
That could be interesting.
It could be very, very interesting. That and you recording tomorrow in Spanish.
Yes, that has to be done like tomorrow.
You could do it. You could do it tomorrow. You are so versatile, and you are so upbeat. I want to wish you continued good health, happiness, and success in whatever you do.
Thank you very much.
We're going to close to kind of bring this back full circle. We opened with Maybe, which is what you did at the beginning of the motion picture, and now we're going to close by going back to Monmouth University. And portions of the film, as we said, were filmed there. This you did a few years ago.
Yes, when they gave me my honorary doctorate, the arts, that was really special.
And this is Aileen Quinn singing tomorrow at that very prestigious event. Aileen, from the bottom of my heart, thank you so very much.
Thank you, Ronnie.
Wow, I didn't think I'd be this emotional. This is for all of you with my love and my gratitude.
Thank you.
your bottom dollar that tomorrow there'll be fun. Just thinking about tomorrow clears away the cobwebs and the sorrow till there's none. When I'm stuck with a day that's gray and lonely, I just stick out my chin and grin and say, oh, the sun will come out tomorrow, so you gotta hang on till tomorrow.
To Ronnie remembers, Ronnie remembers, Ronnie remembers.